Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lawrence Sherman. I'm the director of the Institute of Criminology, and we meet here in the John Maynard Keynes room to hear the first Nigel Walker lecture in its 18-year history, delivered by an economist. Very fitting location, even a statue to go along with the lecture that we are about to hear. But before we do that, I just want to pay special recognition to the person after whom this lecture series is named, the second Wolfson Professor and Director of the Institute of Criminology, Nigel Walker, was someone who was very concerned with the topic of this evening's lecture. And the connection has to do with the appropriate role of penal sanctions in relation to achieving social objectives. The question of what sorts of behavior to criminalize or to legalize once criminalized is a question that has long interested and challenged our lecture this evening. And I will come back to that in a moment with a brief background about the man who has just died since the last Nigel Walker lecture was delivered, and who has just been remembered in a very nice series of discussions over in the hall here at King's College. Professor Walker was a fellow of King's College for his entire term of appointment at this university, and he was somebody who came to criminology, as so many of us do, from one of the diverse paths that make us all see these issues of crime and justice in our particular way. He was a World War II veteran, and certainly reflected in his autobiography, A Man Without Loyalties, on the impact of the war on his generation and on his life. He was somebody who studied grace at Oxford and wound up taking a PhD in psychiatry, which is possibly a fairly rare combination. Perhaps even rarer is to combine it with a career in the Scottish Civil Service, where he had a great deal to do with policies of crime and justice before seeking out an opportunity to pursue his academic interests, and yet, as he emphasizes in this book, never forgetting to make the connections between the subject matter of criminology and the human dimension of the people who are punished by the system, the people who are victimized by those being punished, and the population at large in its moral judgments about what should be done in relation to crime. In his book, Sentencing in a Rational Society, he makes reference to the principle of Montero, a Spanish law professor, in which he cites the major purpose of the criminal justice system is to prevent lynching, so that we provide a more civilized alternative to ways of dealing with these crime problems. I was most impressed that Nigel Walker's most vehement moral claim about the teaching of criminology is that criminology students should meet offenders, should talk to them, should understand what they do and why and who they are and how all of that relates to the study of criminology. And it's no doubt for sentiments like that that, as we discussed in the session remembering Professor Walker's life, the subject of criminology was almost abolished at Oxford before he was appointed there, with the claim that the criminology as a subject was too banausic, which word I recently mispronounced, and I'm happy to pronounce it correctly and spell it correctly, with the explanation that banausic is work that is of the kind done by blacksmiths. And with the application of very practical subject matter to very practical issues of real life, being of great interest to Professor Walker, and of course completely unacceptable to those who wanted to abolish the subject of chronology at Oxford, I think we can see his appointment as a sort of progression of the role of empiricism in both Oxford and Cambridge that arguably was very heavily accelerated by the creation of Cavendish Laboratory here at Cambridge, also against much opposition from people who thought that the study of natural philosophy or science was really not an appropriate thing for a great university to be doing. There's certainly lots of opinions about many things. The opinion we have about Nigel Walker is that he did a great deal of good for the Institute of Criminology, and this lecture series is one of the two things, as Professor Bottoms just mentioned, one of the two things that the Institute of Criminology has established in recognition of his service. The other thing that the Institute has established is a prize of some emolument for the best recent PhD dissertation. And in the most recent meeting of the Nigel Walker Prize Committee, we selected two winners, one of whom is in the U.S., unable to be here with us today. But I'm very happy to say that Esther von Wicket, I hope, is present and is able to rise and receive. Translated after graduating from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, where he grew up. He went to Yale and studied economics with some very great thinkers, and soon found himself as director of research for a national commission on policy with respect to gambling. This was occurring at a time when gambling was being legalized in Atlantic City, New Jersey, had been legalized for some time in Nevada, and the larger questions being raised about whether that idea should spread related to lots of criminological issues such as corruption, organized crime, and even violence associated with that kind of nightlife. It was in that context that I first met Peter Royer, who had found some work I had done on police corruption, and we had some very interesting conversations on how that would relate to the developments in relation to gambling. He went from that legal versus illegal market decision to issues related to drug policy, and at the RAND Corporation went on to found their Drug Policy Center, which is still flourishing in research on several continents. I'm also happy to say that he came to the University of Maryland while I was working there, and we were co-authors with four other scholars of a very communal effort to assess what we know about preventing crime and what we don't know, or what works, what doesn't, and what's promising. And in that context, I realized the broad reach of economics that Professor Royer brought to bear in his work, including economic work on the development of high poverty and high crime neighborhoods, as well as job training and other aspects of marketplaces, which related to both crime and its prevention. In the last several decades, I think Peter Royer has spent more time talking to the people involved in the
legalization of drugs in a wide variety of settings, from parts of the Netherlands to places in Switzerland to the recent deliberations in various U.S. states that have led to legalization. And we have both crossed paths at different times in Uruguay with the very ambitious efforts to understand the consequences of opening retail stores for marijuana, which was scheduled to happen this month, I think. And I'll be going there tomorrow to come back with more data for Professor Reuter's work. But what I have to say is that the emphasis on evidence-based policy that we've both been associated with is challenged by the very fierce devotion to opinion-based policy that many politicians and indeed scholars have in this area, and that sadly much of what is presented as scholarship in this area is, shall we say, policy-based evidence as opposed to getting the facts straight. And when we hear what the facts are, I think it forces us to be sober about the limits and indeed the trade-offs between having various regimes for dealing with both the emotions and the behaviors and harms of drug abuse, drug use, and the control or attempt to control drug use. And at this point, I should hand off to the expert. Please welcome Professor Peter Weir.
Thank you very much. As Larry said, I'm originally Australian, and I come of a generation that suffered from the colonial cringe, which I hope will recognize, a phrase that expressed our sense that, except for the weather, everything was better in England. And giving a talk at King's College, Cambridge, is for my generation of Australian a particular privilege. There's a second reason, though, why Cambridge, as opposed to mainly Oxford, figures in this lecture. I published a book on drug legalization about 15 years ago with Cambridge University Press, and the title, as you can see there, is Drug War Heresies, Learning from Other Vices, Times, and Places. And it's one of those titles that's too clever by half amongst the few bookstores that did actually stock the book. The religious section sometimes was the location. The title that I wanted, that CVP rejected out of hand, but I still think is absolutely the right one, is Everything That You Need to Know in Order Not to Have a Strong Opinion About Drug Legalization. It says what the book has to say. It is an interesting. And this was just before Oxford University Press began its very successful series called Everything You Need to Know About Islam, About the Moon, whatever. But I'm going to talk now about a topic which has deep historical roots. And we've been living for a century, essentially in an era of prohibition. There was a period in which any psychoactive substance was freely available, and we are here in the Fens, where opium was particularly widely used for the purpose of sedating children while the parents were out working, with sometimes disastrous effects. And the prohibition that was implemented both in the US and UK, there are important differences, but there are some similarities, really represented a sort of a sense of that these were problematic substances and something had to be done. Something had to be done at home. Then there were the colonies, and whether we're talking about France, Dutch West East Indies, about Malaya as it was then, even Japan as a colonist in Korea and Formosa. There, of course, an opium monopoly was exactly how you would finance the cost of colonial administration. And what's remarkable, I was really shocked by this, was how long that went on. Now, maybe some antique of the Victorian era, not at all. So finally, this country prohibits opium in Malaya in, I think, 1943, an odd year to pick. The Japanese being in charge at that time. And the French never abandoned selling opium through its monopoly in Indochina. But, yeah, mere exceptions. The rule was prohibition. There were always these pockets of non-compliance apart from colonial regimes. Iran, during the era of the Shahs, mostly had legal production as well as legal consumption. And there's a nice story about how when British imposed sanctions against the oil regime in 1950, they had to go back to growing opium as one of the few sources of government revenue. Well, we've had prohibition for roughly a century. It was 50 years, not much of a problem. I'll skip over that, but it really was not, certainly not a first-order issue, even amongst the chattering classes. But in the last 50 years, it's fair to say that prohibition has caused great harms. This is not a statement about the net harms, merely about the gross harms. And I've just put up a few propositions that I think are relevant here. Heroin dependence is not of itself criminogenic, even though heroin addicts in this society are responsible for a great deal of crime. Heroin markets exist in which heroin costs 10 times as much as gold. That's where the crime comes from. Prohibition. Heroin is not a dangerous drug to use. Picking heroin, more complicated statements about cocaine. It is not, when you look at the list in the medical books about the dangers of heroin use under supervised and clinical clinical conditions, constipation is one of the serious concerns that they have. It is possible to use heroin over long periods of time. It is not good for you, but it is not a particularly dangerous drug. It is sharing dirty needles to inject drugs of unknown purity that is dangerous. The drug enforcement that we have created to implement prohibition, to make prohibition effective, is, I think, divisive, not just in the US, but in this country as well, and I'll present a little bit of data about that. And both in our countries and Asia, has led to a lot of human rights abuses, quite apart from the executions. I refer here to The Wire. I hope everybody knows the best television series ever made. It will become a classic, just like Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky, in the 21st century, this will be. It is not fiction. It is merely the story with a few fictional characters in it. Surely one of the few tales you will read in which a homicidal drug dealer becomes a moral hero. There's a UK problem as well. Not as severe, but it certainly is there. And the West continues to sort of outsource a lot of its production and the problems that go with that to no longer colonies but to developing countries. Mexico's 15,000 murders a year related to drug trade is largely a function of the US market. Here I've got together some from a recent study, the stop and search rates with drugs by self-declared ethnicity in England and Wales, and what you see is that for blacks, the rate is six times what it is for whites, and I think about three times what it is for those of Asian background. Well, what we have to balance against that from prohibition, we have prevention. That is surely, prohibition has reduced the number of those who use And there's a sort of simple expression of what damage drugs do to society. You say total harm is a function of the harmfulness of the drug, the intensity with which the drug is used, and the prevalence of drug use, the percentage of the population that uses. What's conspicuous to us are the harms. We can all identify those that arise largely from prohibition. What's difficult is to show how prohibition has reduced prevalence. And so we have to specify the counterfactual and show how that number has been reduced, and in fact no one can make even a passing guess as to what are the prevalence reducing effects of prohibition at the gross level. So it's hardly surprising that since the problem emerged, the problem of mass markets for drugs, there have been calls for legalization. Of course, Milton Friedman, the archetypal economist, not a Keynesian at all, the opposite of Keynesian, but a very influential figure in social thinking of a libertarian kind, and a very important figure in general for social thinking, was for legalization and made articulate, if ignorant, arguments about it, uninformed arguments, I should say. Gary Becker, perhaps the most significant microeconomist of the last generation, was co-author of an article which showed that taxation is always preferable to prohibition. Well, in a world in which everyone complies with rules, yes, that's the case. But Becker from Chicago is from the very place which has developed political economy, which says all of these things get undermined by the play of incentives of the institutions that are involved, and that is completely ignored in this literature. I probably spend more time than I should on attacking economists because that's where I come from. They are particularly given to simple arguments for legalization. In a way, more important is that there's sort of a broad elite disgust with the existing policies, and a sense that if we don't legalize, there's nothing to be done. This is all so terrible. Those of you who know something about drug policy know my longtime friend and colleague, Mark Kleiman, who's a very influential figure here. And when he was a young professor, assistant professor at the Kennedy School, some senior faculty member asked him what he worked on. He said he's particularly interested in drug policy. And the senior colleague said, why would you be interested in that? And I think that sort of captures the sense that this is one of those areas in which there's nothing to be done unless something radical is done. In contrast to that elite view, there has been very little popular support for legalization, with a very important exception, which is going to be most of what I talk about this evening. But there is no support for the general proposition of legalization, despite a deep pessimism about the effectiveness of anything that the government does now. And that is background. Suddenly, in the US, the most hawkish of countries with respect to drugs, marijuana legalization takes place. Now, my crowd, we are the people who've been thinking and writing about drug policy for the last decade. We know our stuff. Never thought this was possible. We knew it was always, there were always efforts, but they were never successful. We just assumed it would not occur. It occurred. Now, in reflection, we were remarkably blind. So the lower line is the percent in a Gallup poll held annually for 45 years now, asking should drugs be legally available. Should marijuana be legally available? And you'll notice, essentially, it has been going up relentlessly over that time period. We weren't paying attention. Now it is above 50%. It's a little wiggle in the last couple of years. But it's hardly, I mean, we really cannot claim that this should not have come as a shock to us. Four states have now legalized it. California is likely to do it in 2016. District of Columbia, which is still, as they say, the last plantation subject to the whims of a whimsical Congress, is locked in a debate about finishing off legalization. And then from the remote south, Uruguay, for quite idiosyncratic reasons, has also legalized marijuana. So suddenly we actually have something interesting to write about and analyze. Well, questions. It turns out, I will argue, that you can't get to legalization without talking about decriminalization, which is quite different. And what I'm going to deal with is what has been learned from decriminalization. Then I think the big question is what will be learned from marijuana legalization? How should it be evaluated? And then I'll ask a very American question, which is, can legalization actually be constructed badly enough that it will create a nostalgia for prohibition? And I think that that's actually quite a likely outcome. So let me talk about decriminalization. It was very straightforward. Decriminalization is the elimination of criminal penalties for possession or use. No longer at risk of going to jail if caught with small amounts for personal possession. There are still sanctions for these offenses. In Italy, you can lose your passport, professional practice license. Typically, it's traffic tickets, but you know, it could be that you would be required to go into treatment under certain circumstances. Only one country before, one jurisdiction before 2013 had removed all penalties. The Netherlands. The Netherlands, as you know, do things differently. That is, the law still actually says that this is illegal and subject to criminal sanctions. However, there's an overriding regulation, and I'm no lawyer, but I'm living in a country where laws have priority over regulations, but the Dutch seem to do it. So the law is there in compliance with international treaties, but there's a set of regulations which prevent the prosecutor from prosecuting anyone for simple possession of marijuana. And there is some things I'll talk about. Occasionally this discussion about decriminalization is simply reductions in penalties, no analytical interest. Important distinction is legalization positively permits not just use and possession, but supply. So there are no penalties. So do not get confused when people say that Portugal has legalized drugs. Portugal has decriminalized. Many countries have decriminalized. Italy and Spain did it so long ago they can't even remember. There are no evaluations available. Rob McCoon and I in Drug War Heresies tried to use some odd data that didn't work out. In both Italy and Spain, there are administrative sanctions that you get for being arrested, and it is an arrest, with small amounts of any drug, not marijuana, any drug, any psychotic. Portugal, decriminalized in 2001, created a unique sanction system. It's not just administrative fine. If you are arrested, then you a three-person committee decides what's the appropriate sanction, whether you should go into treatment if there's signs of dependence. But it's, for many purposes, just a tweak on an existing system. Latin America is, many Latin American countries, if not most, have in some way decriminalized, Mexico, Argentina, etc. The laws are not well written. The amount specified, for example, in Mexico are so low that almost any drug user, any heroin user, would always be in possession more than the statutory amount. And in Brazil, the police have used this as a way of battling it more, as a way of making more arrests for possession and distribution as opposed to simple possession. It's interesting to look at the motivation for decriminalization. I think, again, it's relevant to the legalization discussion. It varies very much across countries. For Spain, it was really part of getting rid of the Franco regime. Franco, you know, was very intrusive in personal life. And you know, so, you know, even the most conservatives, through at least in the 1990s, were utterly opposed, for example, to wiretapping, and you know, gave the state powers that the populace no longer was willing to give it. And then drug decriminalization was part of that movement of sort of just getting rid of the regime. In Italy, they decriminalized in 1973 because they thought that criminal penalties got in the way of drug users seeking treatment from doctors. Their heroin problem got worse over the next 17 years, so in 1990, they recriminalized. Then in 1993, they re-decriminalized, but that was simply because there were four items on a constitution, on a referendum. The first three were about changing the political system, and they all got yeses, at, you know, sort of 80% yeses. This was the fourth item, it got 52%, and so it became more, and they've never gone back to look at it again. I won't drag this out. In Germany, quite different. Constitutional Court in the early 90s said the state allows alcohol. Criminal sanctions for marijuana cannot be defended. Netherlands. So there are lots of reasons for decriminalization. Notice those are mostly, that's about decriminalization generally. Anglo-Saxon countries, for some reason, are marijuana obsessed. So all of them, the discussion of decriminalization is not about decriminalization, it's about decriminalization of marijuana. It's very distinct. And it isn't all in one direction. Might I remind you that Prime Minister Brown in 2007 reversed a 2004 decision which had, in effect, more or less decriminalized marijuana. Complicated. It's more or less decriminalized marijuana. In Western Australia, there was actually an election fought in which this was, the decriminalization of marijuana was a major issue. I mean, they may have no other things worth arguing about in rich Western Australia, where you know the mining boom has been going on forever, but they reversed it. So while there's a move to decriminalization, it's certainly not without its interruptions. Maybe reflects sort of general shift in sort of conservative attitudes. Well, what do we know about the impacts of marijuana decriminalization? I'm just going to stick with that because for none of the other countries where the decriminalization has been broader do we have anything that I believe would amount to a serious evaluation. Portugal, we can say more about, probably say something. There's no evidence of increases in marijuana use where cannabis remains illegal but decriminalized. So, I was a co-author of a book which reviewed the evidence about 5 years ago, and we found that we still made reliance largely on the older generation of studies, the most important of which is the third one, the Johnson, O'Malley, and Backman, in which they looked at the states that had decriminalized in the 1970s, which is when decriminalization was most active in the U.S., and found that the changes in use between the decriminalized states, the decriminalized and those that hadn't, were not statistically different. The other studies have weaker, that wasn't a strong design, but was better than those. We tried to look at more recent changes in decriminalization. So there's sort of a wave of decriminalization in the 1970s, and there's kind of creeping decriminalization where the word isn't actually used, but it's that the laws are changed in just that way. And discovered a very interesting problem, which is the extreme ignorance of the American population about the laws under which they live. So we included in, it was very nice, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health agreed to include questions about what the respondent believed was the maximum penalty for possession of a small amount of marijuana in the respondent's state. And just look at the middle, unfortunately I don't have a pointer, but look at the middle pair of columns. And so we have states classified as decriminalized states, states with decriminalization, and then the non-decrim states. And in the non-decrim states, fines are maximum. In the decrim states, fines are maximum penalties. 20% of respondents believe that to be the case, in contrast to 14% in states in which, in fact, there was a potential criminal sanction. Look at the third line, maximum penalty being mandatory jail. 6% in decriminalization states believe that they could be subject to a jail sentence, and it's almost 6% for just over 6% for those who live in non-decrim states. So if you ask why might decriminalization not actually have much impact on behavior, we all know that the theory about the effects of laws depend on knowledge of laws. There is little knowledge of the laws under which they live. Nonetheless, decriminalization, even if it doesn't affect marijuana behavior, can reduce the adverse consequences of prohibition. Fewer people go get arrested, acquire criminal records, all the adverse consequences that could come with that. But decriminalization generates potentially net widening. And in South Australia, there's really quite dramatic net widening. In South Australia, which was the first Australian jurisdiction to decriminalize in 1988, the number of arrests increased by, I believe, 250%. Following decriminalization, because it's now easier for the police to deal with someone in possession of marijuana. And more people ended up in jail as a result of not paying the fine than had previously been in jail as a result. So net widening has really been a problem, and I believe in the US, in the UK, after 2004 reclassification, you see this very large increase in the number of individuals who get a street warning, which is still an interference, and I believe that the marijuana is seized, which is itself a non-trivial penalty. So, decriminalization has made little difference to marijuana use. I mean, there is a consensus on that, based on not great evidence. And one reason for that, I argue, is that in fact decriminalization turned out to be a minor change. There are all these arrests, not just in the US and UK, but Switzerland, France, Germany, surprisingly high arrest rates. Almost nobody gets anything other than a fine or a caution. Even in New York City, only 2% of those arrested are sentenced to jail. I did a study about 15 years ago in Maryland, which is not a state which is decriminalized, and I looked, we must have had 1,000 in our sample, and not a single one of them was sentenced to jail. quite a number, spent some time in jail pre-trial, which has its own consequences, but really, you know, if you're asking about deterrent effects, that may well not figure in the potential user's calculation. And net widening increases the risk of some intervention. Even if they don't get jail time, it may be that I did a calculation looking at some data from the Lambeth experiment, which I guess about 10 years ago, there was decriminalization in one borough in the UK, and I thought I could show that there was a chance that with the marijuana seizures and the higher arrest rate that actually the marijuana user was at higher financial, the expected cost of law enforcement interventions was higher under decriminalization than previously. So, so just the example of the very low custody rates. So here are the this was Lambeth before the intervention. This is 1999, and you know, many arrests, 2% result in custody. So just a reminder that many arrests are little punishment. Right. So there's been a lot of decriminalization. Nonetheless, there's been a growing discontent with marijuana prohibition, as expressed in that Gallup poll that I showed before, the changing attitudes. Interesting to me is that race disparities in arrests has become almost the principal message in the attack on marijuana prohibition. And in New York City, that problem's particularly prominent. I mean, New York City is where the newspaper record is published, so we all know much more about New York City than about any other city. It doesn't matter whether some other city gets bigger, so long as the New York Times is what it is, we will know about New York City. You all know the name of the police commissioner in New York City. You don't know the name of the police commissioner in Los Angeles or anywhere else. And New York State decriminalized marijuana possession decades ago, 40 years ago. Yet somehow, the New York Police Department is able to arrest 50,000 people a year for marijuana, simple possession of marijuana. How do they do it? Now, when I first heard the explanation, I thought this was mere left-wing paranoia. The particular author was someone I think I could justify with claiming was left-wing and I could be quite paranoid. He said, it's simple. You stop a young man, you ask him to empty his pocket. Would you empty your pocket, sir? He empties his pocket. It has marijuana. What was decriminalized was simple possession. Public display, that's still a criminal offense. So, off the bat. So, when in 1991, there were only about, there were under 2,000 marijuana possession arrests. By the end of that decade, it was 50,000 and stayed roughly that for 15 years. That mocks decriminalization. It is not surprising decriminalization doesn't have a strong appeal anymore. I think the changing attitudes also come from the spread of medical marijuana laws. Marijuana perhaps has medical value as a therapeutic drug. For lots of reasons, there's minimal research on this, but there's a widespread popular belief, and so now many states allow medical marijuana. Some of them do it in a sort of responsible and restricted fashion, and then you have California. 50,000 licensees, and on the beach at Venice, you know, there are the, you know, Dr. Kush is in, $50, you get your, surely you have a back pain, so. And so there's growing support, as I've already noted, for legalization. But what's, I think, interesting is that there's very little grassroots resistance to this. I mean, this is a, this is deeply embedded. The culture wars, nothing captured the culture wars better than the fight about marijuana, and yet legalization is happening, and it's almost impossible to get a serious funding of a campaign against it in any state. The leader of the anti-marijuana legalization campaign is a man named Kevin Sagan, and calling him a third-rank figure is compliment. He's sort of probably generous. He's risen as a result of this, but no political figure really is strongly for it. There's still a great deal of caution about advocating for this, and none of the governors in the states that have legalized have been enthusiastic supporters of the measures, except one, the governor of Oregon, who lost his seat shortly afterwards for unrelated reasons, just irresponsibility. So you have a situation in which there's, in a sense, an enthusiasm but not leadership for this. Marijuana use is, I will say at the beginning, sort of essentially normalized in Western society. Here's some since all the data study that I was involved in. What I want you to look at is the lifetime figure. So these are, this is for ages, age range 15 to 64. And what you see is that even though that includes some cohorts that had very little exposure to marijuana back in the, when they were young, you're already getting to, high 30s, 40s, and that number is rising. Essentially, marijuana use has become a normal part of the adolescent experience. About by age 21, roughly 50% in the sort of most recent waves of many national surveys will report having used marijuana at least once. Maybe half of those will have used it a dozen times or more. And what I want to talk about now is sort of how we deal with marijuana prior to the legalization, what kinds of problems there are. And here I have to stop myself from getting deeply absorbed in data, which I've been involved with over a long period of time. And this just maps the sort of interesting waves of marijuana use. So in 1980, marijuana use was high. It was very prevalent. It declined by over 50% over the next decade, and then has risen substantially. This is the number of persons who report, based on self-report in a household survey, of having used in the past month. So these are people who are using it. Most of them are using it moderately regularly. Look at the bottom of this, the red line. And this is these are persons who essentially are daily users. And that number goes from a nadir of about 800,000 to a figure in 2013 of about 6 million. So there has been an important change in the composition of marijuana use. Marijuana use has become much more intense than it was before. Not only, as they say, is it not your grandfather's marijuana, but you're using a lot more. And this is occurring in a context in which marijuana seems very expensive. It's about $300 an ounce. And just out of curiosity, how many of you think you know how many grams there are in a joint? I'm not asking you for the answer, I'd just like to know how many of you think you know. Okay. So this $300 is fabulously expensive. This is a naturally occurring weed. Maybe sort of a little bit of ingenuity in the cultivation of it. This is actually kind of $300 an ounce. Sounds very expensive. If you do it on an hour per hour of altered state, and you note that it's only about a third of a gram necessary for a joint. My research assistant says, look, no one smokes a whole joint, it's always shared, but let us not get into that complication, it's already cheap enough. And you weigh it against alcohol, you know, it's comparable to alcohol. He and I are also arguing about what it means to be inebriated by alcohol. I need to go into that here. It's cheap. It's readily available to youth. So every year, sample high school seniors are asked whether the drug is available, readily available. And for marijuana, the figure has always been over 80%. So the vast majority of high school seniors are able to get this in. Figures aren't a lot lower for 8th and 9th. All this is occurring while marijuana possession arrests have been going up. And you know, from 1990 to 2010, they're now declining. But what's very interesting is to then do a conditional calculation. Very simple. What's the probability that someone, used in the past year, was arrested? All I'm doing here is the most basic arithmetic. I haven't done any adjustments. Divided the number of marijuana possession arrests by the number of people who reported marijuana use in the past year. And what you get is a figure of about 1%. At the highest, it's 1.8%. And this is a reminder. Getting arrested for marijuana use is a rare event. And when you think about how often that marijuana is used, there are roughly, the probability of being arrested conditional on using a joint, that is taking an individual episode, is somewhere between 1 in 5,000 and 1 in 10,000. So you ask about the deterrent effect of enforcement and not much probability of being arrested. And here we get to the black-white differences. And it has been true for some time, and the discrepancies have been growing. I do not know what accounts for the decline from 2000 to 2003 in both rates. But the black-white probability differences are substantial. I want to say something here about potency, which will sound out of place, but it will become important later. Potency, average marijuana potency in the US has been rising. This is controversial. There are problems about how the sample is put together. It's a sample of seizures. It's not a sample intended to represent the market. But there isn't much disagreement that there has been a substantial increase over a long period of time in potency, which may have consequences for how dangerous the drug is. And there's been an increase in the number of persons seeking treatment for marijuana use. And you might say, more arrests, more people seek treatment for marijuana use, because if you're a youngster, good advice your parents could give you after you were arrested for marijuana possession is seek treatment. But even if you put aside them, that group, you have a large increase in treatment seeking by others, which is reflected in countries throughout the world, the Dutch, Australia, throughout the European Union. So in summary, the current situation, marijuana use is rising, becoming more intense, there are more treatment admissions, it's becoming more potent. Enforcement never intense is declining, and popular support for marijuana enforcement is eroding. And marijuana is increasingly seen as having medical value, despite the lack of a research base. So, in a sense, this is primed for legalization. And voila, it occurs. First of all, 2012, Colorado and Washington State. 2014, Alaska and Oregon. Also, D.C., which I'll hardly refer to, and there was only legalized homegrown, and I think associations, but there's no commercial reason. But remember, marijuana possession and sales are still illegal at the federal level, and that's a very important constraint on what states can do. For example, it is not a good idea to have the state selling the drug. You do not want to put civil servants in a position where they could be arrested. The big idea of a study that I was recently involved in with a group at RAND, people I've been collaborating with for a long time, was to say there are lots of different models for controlling marijuana. And we've laid them out here on a spectrum from the most restrictive, where we prohibit and we actually increase enforcement intensity, to one in which the state simply says, no prohibition, no anything, do what you want. And the reason we've laid out these models, and I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about them, is that in the US, we say these are the commonly discussed, these are the only options that are discussed. One is more towards decriminalization, that is, less, you know, keep the prohibition, but less enforcement. Just sort of keep the prohibition in place because prohibition is good, but don't do the enforcement which causes problems. Versus the other one, which is let's legalize like alcohol. I frankly would have thought that was not a compelling banner to run under, but it has been adopted by campaigns in many states. So those are the two models that in Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, all assume that they will have a commercial model like the alcohol industry. But there are all these middle ground options, and we've divided them into two groups. One, we think of a small scale, and that is, but you want to start marijuana? Fine, grow your own marijuana. Perfectly doable. The second one is, all right, that's a pain. Join a club in which you sort of pool your resources and you know, somebody does it. It's only can be grown and distributed only to the members, and that's it. And I won't go into the Dutch model in this case. But that sort of gives, it makes legalization meaningful without making it commercial. There's a second set, more complicated, of middle ground options, and I'll just discuss two of these. And these are sort of larger scale, and sort of accepting people don't want to be involved in these relatively intense relationships that are necessary to grow or join a club. One is the government operates the supply chain from beginning to end, and the advantage of that is there'll be no promotional activity. I'll get to why you might disagree with that assumption, but that sort of is the theory of the government monopoly. Another one is to have a for-benefit company in which you have boards that you know, authorize, the state authorizes these corporations whose boards consist of public health, people from public health agencies or from nonprofits that are in the treatment business and things like that. So again, you're allowing for taking advantage of the economies of scale, making it readily accessible, but there'll be no promotional activity. And maybe and the extreme options, which no one talks about really, are the ones where you say, oh, let's take this seriously. Let's prohibit it and make it hurt for people to use. No one thinks that's feasible. And the repeal-only state prohibition is, again, it's kind of the nuclear option that doesn't get discussed. All right. So we've decided to legalize. That is the beginning of a process. Even with any of the models we've talked about, there are issues of regulation and taxation that have to deal with. what is it you regulate? And Colorado, which is the first to implement full-scale legalization, allows home grown. It has a continued medical market. It's a real problem because there's no tax paid on that, whereas they tax the recreational market. Colorado had to deal with something that really was quite unexpected, which is, nonetheless, a purely American product innovation. Oh, we've got a new market, let's develop new products. Think about it. The Netherlands, the Dutch have had this legal distribution system for decades, and they're still just sort of selling weed, and you can get brownies, but they're not very interesting, and not much is made of them. Within 3 months, there are 37 different types of marijuana edibles available in Colorado, and Americans need more regulation, not less, for that kind of reason. And edibles, genuinely, no one had predicted this, account for about 40% of the recreational market now, and there's a concern that young children are exposed to products that are very attractive to them, not because they're looking for marijuana, but because they're attractive products. But let me give you, here we have Sweet Grass Kitchen. Now, imagine that in your kitchen, with a seven-year-old. Is the seven-year-old going to turn that over and read what's on the back about, perhaps there's something about marijuana? No. I picked a fairly innocent-looking one. There are others that are really very attractive. The gummy bears version, that's very attractive. So, of course, the regulations have been changed. You cannot have a product that appeals directly to children now. Difficult to make that work. I love the fact that I just got this. Actually, my wife sent me something about Connecticut, which has a medical marijuana market. And there's someone there, an ambitious cook, who has produced cannabis-infused chocolate hazelnut French macaron. And it turned out to be quite difficult to do, and the market isn't big enough to justify it. But it sort of just gives you a sense of how they will, this is a country where everything will get pushed to the edge. The regulations have been revised, but it's important to note that the providers have a powerful voice in the country. So what kind of regulations might you apply? Well, I've just put up here, this comes out of a study that I contributed to, some of the things that you might regulate. You might decide what products are permitted. You might decide to be Dutch and just say, the weed, that's it. Additives product, potency. Do you allow providers to sell highly, high THC content marijuana? You create a THC ceiling, or you maybe submit, most of you will be surprised to hear, a CBD floor. This is not the Central Business District. CBD refers to another component of marijuana called cannabidiol. I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly, but in CBD for these purposes. CBD is the good part of marijuana, and the ratio of THC to CBD may be the most important characteristic of marijuana in terms of how it affects the users. So, what is it you regulate in terms of potency or strength, product labeling, etc.? So there are a lot of decisions to be made, and you can make very bad decisions here. You can make very bad decisions, and you can also face a problem that is, again, quite American, which is you might decide you want to restrict promotion of marijuana. We have decided to make marijuana legal not because we think marijuana is a good thing, but because marijuana prohibition has been somewhat destructive. Well, you would prefer to restrict advertising. Well, as you well know, this court believes that corporations are persons and have First Amendment rights, and so restricting promotion has turned out to be extremely difficult. At the moment, actually, we don't have that problem because since it's not legal federally, You can't use the airwaves. So that makes that part of life easy. The other limit on regulation, unique but perhaps extreme in the US, is, of course, the industry acquires political power against regulation. The history of liquor control since repeal is that of continual erosion of regulatory restrictions. So let me turn from regulation to taxation. And taxation was certainly one of the motives for marijuana legalization emerging around 2010 when the states were in terrible financial trouble. I was involved in another study, RAND study, which we estimated the size of the expenditures associated with each of the four major drugs, and for marijuana, we estimated in 2010 the figure was about $40 billion. And in one sense, well, most of that is profit. In another sense, most of it is risk compensation for taking the risks of getting arrested, incarcerated, drug seized, etc. This is an attractive potential tax source. But the obvious taxation issue is you raise the taxes, you ensure that too high, the black market will persist. What I'm more interested in is no one is sure about the best way to tax. So you can tax per unit weight, but if what the users are seeking is THC, then the obvious thing is to make the marijuana as potent as possible. On the other hand, if you tax on the unit THC, that sounds easy, but in fact it's quite expensive with current technologies and difficult to test for THC because it's not evenly distributed across the products. It's not like a vat of whiskey where you can just sample and be sure that you're representing the whole vat. And I'm conscious, and I take my clue from my that I should be conscious of how many minutes do I have? 5. Yes, I thought that would be the answer. As I say, I do like this subject. I'm sorry. does that. So I won't go about how we choose amongst tax bases. What, in fact, I'm great deal. Let me talk about public health. Assessing the effects of legalization on public health is complicated because marijuana is associated with all sorts of adverse outcomes. There's little of the research that's strong enough that you can make a causal statement about that. But do remember, we're dealing with a complicated weed. I make up the year, but it's something like we know as much about marijuana now as we did about tobacco in 1950, maybe 1955. Some number, some year like that. We know, the can never be old story. 10 years ago, that was unknown. And in the sense that we're just sort of starting down the path of learning about what makes this a dangerous or therapeutic. Drug. The wild card in assessing the effects of legalization is the effect of this on use of other substances. So I'll focus on alcohol. There are lots of studies that try to look at whether alcohol and marijuana are substitutes or complements. Does increased marijuana use lead to more alcohol use or less alcohol use? Many studies, no consensus. You can find results that are quite strong on either side, you know, large effects on both sides, lots that show no effect. It's quite important for prescription opioids, it may well be that marijuana is a substitute for prescription opioids. When you think about that, legalization could be a major public health threat. It might, if it is a substitute for heavy drinking by young males. I'm sure many in this audience will resonate to the notion. You reduce heavy drinking by young males, big effects on violence, crime, motor vehicle accidents, etc. John Calkins and some others have estimated, back in the envelope calculation, that a 10% reduction in drinking would, in terms of social harms, offset a 10%, a doubling of marijuana use. Of course, the relationship could differ in the long run and the short run, but this was a long run calculation. So it could be a major public health gain, could be a major public health disaster. What if they're complements? Then it all runs in reverse. Marijuana and smoking are highly correlated. A 1% increase in cigarette smoking, you take the standard 400,000 excess deaths, that's 4,000 annual. And from the evaluator's point of view, this is really bad news because these are behaviors that will take a long time to develop. When will people figure out what is the right balance between alcohol and marijuana? So that brings me more or less to the end that I have to have. So we have here the sort of four alternative policies that I've laid out. And the question is, how should we evaluate them? How should we think about them? Well, we would like to have a system. Look at the second of the criteria columns. We would like to have a system in which the users know about what it is they're consuming, and they have assurance of the quality. We'd also like to have a system in which legal suppliers don't have an incentive to promote useful harm to harmful to public health, as the alcohol industry does. We'd like to look at the last column. We'd like to generate high state revenue. Well, no option dominates across those. Here's a set of judgments by a set of supposed experts. And which one is to be preferred? Well, it very much depends on how you value different aspects of this problem. Having talked about the US endlessly, let me remind you, I did mention Uruguay. And Uruguay is going about it in a completely different way. It's very interesting. I mean, this is a top-down innovation. President Mujica, a most unusual political figure, picked this as one of his pet projects. Two-thirds of the populace are opposed. Two-thirds of Latin Americans are opposed to any legalization of anything. But the opposition is not really impassioned, and so they sort of let it go ahead. The model that they're trying to implement is very controlled. Yes, you can grow your own, but you've got to register with the government. Yes, you can join a cooperative, you've got to register with the government. Yes, you can buy from pharmacies when eventually they get around to getting it all in place, which they haven't yet. But you've got to register with the government, and you've got to choose one of those three. You can't have more than one of those three. You either grow your own, belong to a club, or buy from the pharmacy. I do not ask me to explain, and a very limited range of products allow. But it's a wonderful contrast with the models in the US, and I think there will be a lot of evaluation. I can say, there is, I'm surprised at how much people, not just people I hang around with, but real people, talk about the importance of seeing what happens in the early movers. And there's a sense in many states, let's see what happens in Colorado and Washington, and in Latin America, there are says, Let's see what Uruguay does. If anybody can do it, it's Uruguay. The only bureaucracy to join the United Nations as a nation. And they should be able to do it right. The National Center of Health is very much involved in evaluations. And the Open Society Foundations is funding an independent assessment of what happens in Uruguay. So I think we will actually have a lot more. I have to... I will now conclude as my. There are many options for legalization of marijuana. They all involve trade-ups. What options are best depends on. And there's clear interactions. Vermont could make out like a bandit if no other state legalizes marijuana. It could make hundreds of millions of. I'm sorry, why did I pick Vermont? Because that's what the state that generated the stuff. But of course, other states will respond. The same happens with countries in the European Union. From my point of view, what's most important is that you choose an option which allows you to reverse the decision if it turns out to be a mistake. And it may well turn out to be a mistake. Human rights issues notwithstanding, the commercial model is the one where it's going to be most difficult. And unfortunately, I think that we have opened that, started down that path, and we're very hard to move away from that. But let me finally conclude by saying legalization has many enemies, and they're not all what Australians would call wowsers, or just people who don't like other people having a good time, or people who don't understand the issues. Almost everybody involved in research and treatment communities and prevention communities is absolutely opposed. Here are some comments from Nora Volko, the head of the National Center on Drug Abuse, a very distinguished neuroscientist. She's been head of the NIDA for over a decade, and she's not a political figure. She is absolutely straight. H index of 150 or something like that. She speaks with authority. And from her point of view, how can you legalize a dangerous drug? To which the answer of a policy researcher is, how can you not pay attention to everything else that's affected by this decision? But there are many who simply see it this way. How can you legalize a dangerous drug? Now, I wanted to find a Keynes quote to sort of finish up with, but nothing in the end. In the long run, we were all dead. It didn't work. So, second best, Churchill. So, America can always be counted on to do the right thing after it's exhausted all other options. I fear it will not, in this case, get beyond the options. Thank you.